Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
Well, it is morning time here in Texas, and I'm going to say good afternoon. I've done it again. I've landed a great guest, and what we've done here is we've decided to record this episode prior to the 1 o'clock live show that we usually do here on the American College Experience. And I'm very fortunate today to have this guest. He's a good friend that we've had on the show before. His name is Jeff Moore. Jeff is a former national champion collegiate coach in the tennis world. He guided the Texas Longhorns to some national championships down in Austin, Texas. And we're following up with Michael Center, who we had last week. We didn't intend on doing this. We were chasing Jenny Mines out of Alabama, and Jenny had something come up at the last moment. She's been doing real well there in Alabama, and she's agreed to come on at a later date. And Jeff was gracious in doing so here. And he and I have been visiting a couple of times about some ongoing, I'll call it just straight as it is, athletic problems within the NCAA. And we're gonna kind of traverse through these waters today, but we're going to take an interesting spin about what's going on in today's athletic world, in particular with what's happening in the tennis world, and see what's happening. As many of you know, I have been looking at things in a little different light with what's going on with the NCAA, the ITA, the USTA, the scoring changes. What's happening out there in the college tennis world. I'm afraid that we might be losing doubles as a part of our sport, and we're going to talk to Coach Moore about that. We've had these, as Coach Chuck Creasy calls them, the bullwinkle systems that are coming about. You know, we're playing shortened sets, and sometimes we're not even playing the doubles in some of these systems. And then most recently, at the NCAA basketball tournament, we've had the unionization of college sports thrown about. We had the basketball player from the University of Connecticut that claimed he couldn't eat at his school and claimed that the school was making money because they were selling his sports jersey. The NCAA retaliated to that claim and then came out about a week to 10 days later and said, hey, we'll feed our athletes as much as we can. We're sorry about this. We didn't intend on not feeding our athletes, which, you know, in my opinion, for what it's worth, just was a stopgap measure there. We've got some interesting things happening in the NCAA world, including this summer we've got the Ed O'Bannon issue, which is going to come out. And as many of you know, that is the video game issue in which the NCAA seemed to have profited off EA Sports putting the athletes in an NCAA sports game, but didn't pay the athletes any money for using their images. So we'll keep an eye on that. And to tie this all together, and this is what's going to be interesting today, Coach Moore has recently published a book, and this is what's unique. And I this is where I believe Coach Moore is way ahead of his time, and he's starting to get recognized for this in the business world. And this is what made him so special at UT. He came up with the idea of Strivers, and his book Raising Strivers is something that we're going to tie this into. Into kind of what's wrong with the athletic culture today, and before I get too involved in it, and you can get this book on Amazon.com, and I'm going to let him talk about it today. I've been reading some of it myself, and it's just fascinating. And he and I have visited through the course of the years about this idea, and I'm a firm believer in what he's got. But we're going to start out today, and just bring him in here and get going. So let me bring him in. Hello, Coach Moore, are you there?
Yes, Jason, how are you?
I'm fine today. So glad to have you on the show. It's been a little while, so let's have our listeners kind of catch up with what you've been up to there in Austin, Texas.
Well, after I retired from coaching at the University of Texas, I became an athletic director at a local school here in Austin, Trinity Episcopal School. Wasn't real sure what I wanted to do next, and I had grown up around the independent school world. My dad was a head of school at four different schools all around the country. So I grew up in that environment, and it was kind of second nature to me. I learned a ton besides enjoying being back with the kids. Actually, strangely enough, in this era, I really enjoy talking to parents. Really enjoyed putting together an athletic program for a school. I learned a ton. In the end, it wasn't quite as uncomfortable as I like to be in coaching. As most people know, if you're going to coach at the college level, you have to be almost fanatical. You have to be obsessed with it to be good. Well, I wasn't ready to go back into coaching. I wasn't that serious. I wasn't ready to be a fanatic again. But I did need something to make me a little bit more uncomfortable. So I decided to start my own business. It's called Moore Leadership. And what I do is I help companies find and develop top performers, people I call strivers. And I've developed an assessment called the Striver Quotient Assessment Tool that assesses people based on performance, not personality, so that companies, schools, and organizations of all types can create a sustainable culture as they grow.
And now, Jeff, we're going to...
exciting, but it's been a learning curve.
Yeah, and we're going to... We've got some, as I mentioned in the beginning here, we've got some interesting areas to cover today, and we're going to... I think the best way to approach this is to go from kid, maybe the parent, to the business world today. And I think that's in reading your book, it kind of starts with the kid in this, and that's, you know, you open with an interesting story in your book about kids, your own kids, and I think that's perhaps where your passion started in observing children. Is that right?
Yes. Well, I originally had started out to write a management book, and the stories that I was coming up with from my coaching past were wonderful. That part was exciting. But trying to come up with management language and getting into that, I got mired down. I got a little bit worn out and got tired of looking at all the management books, most of which sound alike. And I said, you know what, let's flesh this out a little bit more and write a parenting book, which parents, of course, are leaders as well and probably have definitely have a tougher job than leaders in any other area, endeavor. So I wrote an e-book called Raising Strivers, and I used my own experience as a parent, teacher, and coach, and now businessman to try to lay out what the world looks like today, what kind of world these young people are inheriting. I don't think people in my generation and your generation, the baby boomers and the Gen X, I don't think we totally have a grasp on how challenging the world is that these young people are going to inherit. And then I tried to explain what these kids, the kinds of qualities and skills these kids will need when they enter that world.
Well, it is going to be one scary place. I agree. We're really not prepared for. I mean, it is moving so fast right now, Coach. I mean, and you've shared with me, you know, with the internet and the way it moves so fast. I mean, it's just downright scary.
Well, and the challenge, it used to be for a long time, your IQ was what determined, or at least that was how people just hired and the basis for which companies, schools, organizations would select people. Then in 1995, Daniel Goleman wrote Emotional Intelligence, and the whole idea of EQ, people skills, became very popular, and that was, of course, a much-needed upgrade. The problem today is that product cycles are so short that the key has been how will you respond change. And the simplest example is, Jason, if you're working for me and you've designed the Wonder Gadget and, you know, and I've recognized that, Jason, it's wonderful. You finished it about a month ago. But, Jason, we discovered that there's a woman in Estonia who's developed a better prototype. So, Jason, you need to go back to the drawing board and retool this gadget. And Jason typically would say, well, you know what, I went to MIT. Wait a minute, what are you talking about? I know, Jason, you went to MIT. I'm not even sure she went to college, but that's not the point. You need to retool this gadget. So the issue becomes, we know Jason's brilliant. Jason's wonderful with people, but how does Jason respond? Just like it's always been in sports, how does Jason respond to change? That has become what the challenge is, because when you and I entered the workforce, we could have a certain skill set and get a job and hold it through our careers, get the watch, and retire. Today, young people entering the workplace are expected to have between 15 and 25 jobs over their careers. And we already know the high unemployment rates and underemployment rates for young people. They're not going to make as much as we did. Their life expectancy is not expected to be as quite as great. So the challenge is, and that's just the beginning, we know the kind of world they're going into. It's more unstable than ever. So they're headed for some incredible challenges, and it's going to be important for them to be able to respond to that, not just respond, use these challenges as an opportunity.
Well, Jeff, when did you, just as a young coach, a young person in the business, when did you start to notice that you had a knack for looking at kids or talking to parents about their kids?
Well, when I retired from UT, I swore I would never talk to another parent, because what had happened is, around the late 90s, the millennials started hitting campus. And all of us coaches, not only at UT, but all over college sports, we were, what's just hit us? Because all of a sudden, there was not only entitlement, there have always been spoiled kids in every generation, but what was really, really alarming was that the recruits coming onto campus had no sense of self. Everything had been done for them. They were coming off of an assembly line. Instead of saying, hey, I'm pretty good, what can you do to help me get better, and can I have a key to the courts so I can practice whenever I want? It changed from that to, and this is assuming the child was allowed to speak, you know, instead of the parents in the first place, but if he or she was, the tone would be, I'm pretty good, what are you going to do to get me to the pros? What gear do we use, and how long do we practice? Just totally out of whack, and no original thought, no real strong sense of self, no what I would call spunk. Because what I had been accustomed to being able to identify was an athlete with edge, someone who would walk in what I call good high maintenance, someone who had a little bit of a chip, something to prove, sort of a wild bronco type that meant well. You know, how many 17-year-olds aren't wild broncos to some degree? And, you know, my job would be to tame them, help tame them, and help them grow as people and as players. And it got to where those kids still existed in the late 1990s forward, but they were much harder to find, and that's how I started to develop. That's why I started to develop the assessment.
Do you?
Jason, I wanted to say one more thing. What I discovered, which was interesting, when I retired from coaching and started speaking to all kinds of groups, I discovered that the geeks, the so-called not the non-athletes, certainly the non-elite athletes, including the artistic crowd, that those segments within the millennials, they are, sometimes in their own weird way, they are competing. What was really depressing was that they're out-competing the athletes because, again, the athletes typically tend to be, if they play through the varsity, certainly into college, in many cases they tend to be commoditized, and they arrive in the workforce the same way they arrived on campus. I deserve to be here. I'm wonderful. Pay me.
Well, what I'm curious about here, Jeff, is as you ventured from athletics into the business world, and a good friend of mine, and you're aware of him, Coach Gould, had told me very early on in my coaching career about the rule, the 2 of 3 rule, which was you can be a good student, you can be a good athlete, or you can have a good social life as a college athlete. And he said you can be 2 of 3. You cannot be all 3. And he stated that if you notice in your athlete that they're a good athlete, but their grades are not good, then you can fully be aware that they are partying, you know, that they have a great social life. And and the same is true if their tennis was good and their grades were bad, they had a good social life. What I'm curious about here is the same true for the aforementioned geek? Without the athletics being involved in their life, were the athletes ahead of them in regards to their attitudes towards life? Were they behind them? Did you notice that you had somewhat of an advantage looking at them and saying this is what's going to happen? Or you know, do you understand what I'm saying here?
Well, the geeks have a huge advantage now because, and so do the so-called indies, the artistic, because in the case of the geeks, they started writing code on their computer when they were 8, and parents, my generation, didn't know how to commoditize that, didn't know how to find a coach, didn't understand it, so they left their kids alone. So those kids own that. And now they're in the workplace completely intrinsically self-motivated. The artistic crowd, it used to be that if you were talented artistically, I know my parents would have said, Jeff, that's wonderful work you're doing, but what are you going to do with that? Today, if you are creative, you've got the ticket, period. So these kids not only are ready for the discomfort of the real world, they thrive in it, whereas athletes, most elite athletes have never been allowed to be uncomfortable. They've had coaches in some cases since they were 6. They've had personal trainers. They've had parents take them anywhere. In some cases, the parents are their coaches. So they've never been allowed to be uncomfortable. And that's what school's about. School is not the transactional part of school is getting the degree, okay? Everybody gets the degree. Well, who can't get a degree today when 43% of the grades given are A's? Who can't get a degree with just a little bit of effort? I'm not dismissing the cost. That's the big challenge today. But that's the transactional part. What's really valuable about college, in my mind, for my boys anyway, it was hugely valuable, is those relationships you develop with professors or coaches where they make you stretch. They challenge you. That's what my wife and I were desperately hoping our kids would have a chance to interact with, is people like that. Because they change. That's what you carry into the real world. You don't carry a degree in X because those are, you take a test, and when you study something knowing that you're going to have to take a test, research shows you forget most of it. So what you take forward are the life lessons from those experiences that you have, those relationships with coaches and teachers and even peers. But unless you can be allowed to be uncomfortable, and in sports that's just not an option, then it's impossible to take lessons like that forward.
Well, Jeff, I mean, we're in the age now where we're dealing with the quote-unquote athletes that grew up in the age where trophies were given out to everybody. You know, you always got you got a medal just because you participated. I mean, what is this doing to our youth?
Well, it's a real problem. And again, the entitlement is certainly an issue. But you know, the baby boomers. We had plenty of spoil. We had our own set of issues. And by the way, I blame the whole grade inflation. I blame the trophy kid mentality on my generation, because we raised those kids. We created that. We did not want our children to be as uncomfortable as our parents had been during the Depression. That's kind of the theory. But for whatever reason, we created that. We are running Washington. We are running Wall Street. We are running schools. And when the boomer generation exits stage right, things will improve dramatically, immediately. So I want to make sure people understand, I don't blame the millennials. In many ways, they're definitely victims. So, and again, the most alarming thing is not the entitlement per se to me. It's the lack of sense of self, because going into the world that these kids are entering, they're going to have a very strong sense of who they are. I speak to student groups, and I also speak to businesses. And what I've seen, and we've talked about this, is an alarming difference. I can speak to a group of undergraduate business students who are in their early 20s, 20, 21, 22, and there's no pulse in the room. It's just another day at the office. If they get a 89, they complain to the professor, can I write a paper, any paper, to get over a 90. Then I go over to a financial advising company I spoke to the other day, and all of a sudden in front of me are 23, 24, 25-year-olds who have just graduated, and they've been in the work world for a year or two, and they're scared to death. There's a sense of urgency. That room is completely different. They are completely locked into what I'm saying. They are completely engaged. And what's most promising, in many cases, they get excited because it's for the first time in their lives, they're being told by their leader, can you please do more? What do you have to offer intrinsically? Because the extrinsic motivators are gone. No boss wants to listen to a parent or a personal coach or a tutor. So all that support structure is gone, and that's the hopeful side of it. But there's a huge difference in a year or two between being a student, where there's no discomfort, relatively no discomfort, aside from the considerable cost of education, and talking to that very same person a year or two later in the workplace when reality hits them.
Well, Jeff, in this show, we talk about the American college experience, the American collegiate experience for tennis in particular. I mean, and as you went through it, you saw a tremendous amount of ups and downs. And, you know, we are in a tremendous drought now, in which we're not turning out the players that we used to turn out. I mean, is this because of something that you've seen in relation to what you're saying here as far as the Striver quotient goes?
I think so. I we're not turning out players on the world scene. The United States is not. So I think it's an overall – we're not – the only sport I can think of that we're consistently number one in is basketball. And you would hope that we could beat Spain, which has 30 million people and not the resources, and countries like that. So we're number one in basketball. But of the sports that other countries play along with us, I don't know of another sport where we're clearly number one. And in tennis, we're way behind. So I think it's a problem that goes beyond college. I just don't think that, again, from a young age, the opportunity to compete is taken away from the kids. And the opportunity to compete means, in many cases, when they're young, is leaving them alone, giving them an opportunity to play, to form their games, to develop a little bit of an attitude. And then as they grow older, putting them in situations where they have to solve problems and compete and taking emphasis off of the goal, which is the scholarship. The problem is, and this is true in any company or any school, any competitive endeavor, when you keep talking about results and the goal, when that is the conversation constantly, the bar gets lower and lower and lower versus talking about the process. What are you doing today to get better? What are you doing, Jason? Not me, your coach, helping you do. What are you taking responsibility for in terms of making yourself better? That's how you compete for and win for national championships. You get people who, players, athletes who are saying that to themselves. You hire into a corporation workers that say, that don't say reward me, they say push me. Believe me, the money will be there, but they say push me. So that's really what we're lacking, is an environment where we can produce young people with that sort of attitude. In my opinion,
well, Coach,
that is societal.
Yeah, you know, we've always been taught to put the horse in front of the carrot, but that doesn't seem to be holding true any longer. I mean, what are you saying here? I mean, that we need to get behind the horse and push it?
Well, I think the culture needs to be, the sports culture in particular, which is really a catastrophe. Again, other parts of the culture have issues, but, and I've talked about the schools in general, and then just societally we have parenting, you know, there's too much entitlement, for sure. There's too much hands-on. There's over-parenting, for sure. But for the most part, the parents, I think in your generation, the Gen X generation, my generation is the one that created this mess. Your generation's a little bit younger. Your generation's caught up in it, but you're listening. It wasn't your agenda. So I think there's great hope. Sports will be the last to pick up on this, because your child plays in public. There's a scoreboard. It's a little bit analogous to SAT scores, to grades. There's a rating. So there's this great temptation to make sure my child compares favorably to yours, rather than is my child competing. We've got to get back to that. And it used to be that parents didn't even go to games. Now they want to go to practices. Parents didn't go to school unless they were told they needed to be there. I'm not saying that's the ideal either, but we've done a complete 360 when we probably needed to do a 180.
Coach, I mean, everything I've read about this generation says that they're not living longer than their parents. You know, what are we going to do?
No, that's what the stats are saying. Well, I think that's because of the obesity rates and the nutrition. And then what's more alarming is they're not going to make as much as we have made. They're not going to realize the benefits of their hard work. At least that's what's projected. I have a great deal of faith in, more than most people, again, in the millennial generation as a whole. I will say, and I told I've got five brothers and sisters, they're all younger, and my youngest brother is 12 years younger, and he's got fairly young kids, and I just told him, I said, you know, if your children, and they're all athletes, they get interested in something besides sports, take a good, and passionate, more importantly, get out of sports. And, of course, they look at me as if, hey, I'm a good parent, but you're in that culture. So if your child gets a passion for music or writing code or something else, something they actually have a passion for, go for it, because it's very difficult in the environment we're in now to get into sports and come out the other end with a competitor. You're going to come out the other end with a comparator, scholarship or no scholarship. So it's not a good time, in my opinion. It's not a good time to start a coaching career. We're losing a lot, and my oldest son is an example. We're losing a lot of great teachers and great young coaches because of the environment, because they are not able to create a discomfort in the practice environment, and you know what I mean by that. Discomfort that will force their athletes to solve problems and get better. You can't get better unless you allow yourself to get uncomfortable and solve problems. There's no way, and that's true, of course, about everything. So that's why we're losing a lot of coaches and teachers. Very, very sad.
Coach, statistically, we've got over 300,000 students in the United States of America that play high school tennis. The USTA only has about 24,000 athletes in their junior program. Do we have enough strivers in that program there to make a dent in competitive college tennis to then make a dent into top 10 pro tennis in the future?
Well, I don't know, but right now I'm just worried about our youth, because I'm more worried about our country. I'm more worried about the future that the world that our kids will inherit, the world that our kids will be living in and operating within. And you heard me speak to the high school coaches at the Texas Tennis Coaches dinner. A couple of years ago, I think they hold the key. Unfortunately, in many cases, they're not empowered. They hold the key because, unlike a person at an academy, it's not a business. The kids and the parents are stuck with that coach for 4 years, which is wonderful, because then the coach can create the kind of environment I'm talking about and can really make an impact on a child. Because the key is not what they do at the next level with their tennis. The reason we coach is to make an impact on their lives after sports. Because when they're done with sports, which for 99% of them is at age 20, at least age 22, they got the rest, two-thirds of their life done. They're just beginning their lives. So what have we done to impact them in a way where they carry lessons over? Look at Magic Johnson, Hakeem Olajuwon, Roger Staubach, three names I just pulled up. You never see people like that coming out of sports anymore. They are more successful in the real world than they were in sports, because they understood that they were going to have to compete with people like you and me who couldn't, and they understood that one of the things that keyed their success in sports was their talent. Talent is hugely important in sports, whereas in the real world, they were going to have to compete. They understood that. We don't see that as much anymore, and that's why businesses are not quite as anxious to hire athletes anymore, the smart ones, because they're afraid of getting that commoditized individual. So I think the high school coaches hold a big key in this. And then college coaches, the problem is by the time they reach college, they're molded and they're on scholarship. So the coach is stuck, in a sense.
Coach, do you have an opinion as to why on the professional tour in doubles, our collegiate players seem to be doing better as far as getting a ranking and making somewhat of a living than on the singles tour?
Well, they play doubles in college. I guess that's probably the reason. We don't, singles, they don't do as well on their own, because tennis, as you and I have discussed, tennis is the most difficult sport to play. I told you a quick story about one of my former players, Kelly Pace, who was a great college player, helped lead us to our second national championship, did well on the Pro Tour, top 100, top 150, and then retired. And then in her early 30s, she'd always played golf, but she decided to take it seriously. Well, within 3 years, she's the number one amateur golfer in the U.S., and she's within three strokes of making the LPGA Tour. So I asked her recently, what's tougher? She said, oh, my gosh, tennis. I think it's the toughest sport to play. And with today's kids, I'm not sure how many of them are willing to put up with the frustration that comes with trying to master the most difficult game that there is to play by themselves, because other than college or high school, it's an individual sport. I just think it's hard. So I guess doubles is the skill set can be a little bit less important. The talent factor is less important. I don't know. The top players don't play doubles in many cases. Is that still the case, actually? You know, I don't in the big tournaments. So that might be the reason. So,
yeah, it's perplexing. We've got the Bryan brothers that are the most successful doubles team in the history of our sport, and they're aging, and they're probably the only team out there left that actually plays doubles, as you and I would, and very successful with.
Yeah, and they're from a different generation. They're badass. They work hard. They compete. They're from a completely different. You know, they're older. They were tremendous. So it's going to be sad to see them go, because they've set such a great example.
Well, Coach,
there's
that
no
leads...
talk with them. It's, they walk the walk. They're the real deal.
Well, and that's led me to something that I'm afraid of. I mean, and I've shared this. I mean, once the Bryan brothers, once they leave our sport in doubles, and we've seen this, I'm afraid it's going to die. I mean, I don't see why the Pro Tour keeps it. There's nobody in the stands watching it. They don't show it on TV.
Right.
McEnroe already called for it to end. In college tennis, we've gone from an 8-game pro set to this 6-game fluke where you play a tiebreaker at 5-all. I mean, what's the point in it? I mean, we're kind of, it's like we're phasing it out.
Well, college, the one school of thought is college tennis can't survive unless it can be marketed, and it can't be marketed. And I'm just telling you what some people, many administrators view it, unless the match is shortened. And you and I both know how exciting college tennis can be, because it's actually a team sport, and it's not like Davis Cup where it's one match at a time. Davis Cup also is thrilling, but it's different. It's the only sport that is truly a hybrid, because you've got, in the case of singles, 6 players on the court on adjacent venues doing the same activity at the same time. It's not like swimming or track where this event, that event, field events over there, track here, sprints here, long distance later. It's a true hybrid, and that's, to me, what makes it fascinating. It's also college tennis, high school team tennis, is the closest analogy to the business world of any of the sports for that reason, because you have separate cubicles all working at the same time on the same activity. They have to be a team, but they also have to be strong individually. It's just hard. It's difficult to market it, and right now marketing is everything in college sports. Everything. Everything revolves around marketing, so college tennis is struggling to keep up, and I know many of the coaches would prefer not to make some of the moves that they've had to do with doubles.
I've said this many a time here, is that, you know, you take a group of this is what's funny to me about athletics and sports in general. You take a individual sport like tennis, and you throw it together, as you say, in a college dual match, and these kids learn how to play a team sport far better than anyone on a quote-unquote team sport who turn themselves into a group of individuals.
Right. You mean in college tennis?
In college sports in general. I mean, you take a group of basketball players, and they are far more consumed with becoming a group of individuals than they are with becoming a team. Whereas you take a tennis team, which is taught as an individual sport, and they love becoming a team.
Right, right. Well, I mean, if you listen to Coach K and Bobby Knight, they said recently, both of them, almost simultaneously, they were asked, so who are some of the great teams today? And they were talking about sports, and they said, quite frankly, this is Coach K talking, he said there are no more great teams, there are just groups of individuals.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's when someone at that level makes that kind of statement, you know, that just shows you where we're at. I think it's true throughout sports. Basketball, I know what you're saying. You're talking especially about the NBA, and the other sport that I've coached is basketball, and really that is, along with tennis, I think those two sports are among the worst in terms of the entitlement, in terms of the marketing, in terms of the AAU culture. And what's ironic is when I coached my son's AAU team for 2 years, went all over the country, and I thought, well, I've got some kids on my team that either don't have parents or their parents aren't around. So I'm thinking, well, these will be really hungry kids. And in some cases, they were worse, and only because the AAU handlers nursed them along with money and enticements. They entitled them. So in many cases, even though they were from a much lower socioeconomic bracket, they were even worse. They were entitled by a different source, the AAU culture. So those two sports, though, I've found, because it does differ by sport, are the most affected. Talking to Coach Barnes recently here at Texas, what he's been through, it's very similar to what I went through at Texas, what all the college tennis coaches have to face today. So.
You know, and this is where the small colleges we tend to outdo you big guys, and Coach K, all respect to him, is that if he wants to go see a real team, he needs to go see a small college tennis match at Nationals, because that's where the team atmosphere lies. I mean,
right, and they were beaten by Mercer in the tournament, which is a small school.
Yeah,
basketball tournament. Yeah. No,
yeah,
I agree. Small college tennis is terrific, because you know the kids are there because they want to be, because they're not getting a scholarship, for sure.
Yeah.
So I agree with you.
Yeah.
I think the key, though, Jason, is parents. We've talked about this.
Yeah.
I think the key to the whole thing, because parents are – They run the business world. Again, they run the government. They're parents of their children. In many cases, they are their children's coaches in the early years. So I think they're the key to the whole thing. And of course, you as a parent, me as a parent, we're very different as a parent than we are on the job, because it's our flesh and blood. There's just much more emotion attached to it. So how we handle that is crucial. That's what's changed so dramatically. And if we can get that turned back around, I think there's great hope. And I really do think your generation and the one behind you will listen. I think they're, you know, it's history goes in cycles, and I think things go in cycles. And, you know, I have great hope that this is going to turn around. And that's one of my goals, is to talk to more and more parent groups about the book I've written
Now, Coach,
as a learning experience for these parents. No, go ahead.
As you travel through your final years there at UT recruiting athletes, did you notice that the parents were getting less involved or more involved in the student athlete experience?
Much more involved. You talk to college coaches who are still active would be hesitant to talk about it, because they're still in the game. But if you talk to them privately, especially at the high Division I level, it's insane. I mean, I would get phone calls. You know, my daughter is not progressing. You know, her game is not progressing. She wants to play on the professional tour. And, of course, the parents 1,000 miles away isn't at practice. If the parent was at practice, they would see that I'm having trouble getting this person to put in effort for more than an hour in practice. And this person is, as Dick Gould pointed out, this person is doing plenty of partying. So, no, I got to a point where I refused to talk to parents about anything related to their child's sport completely. And you know, when we were contending for national championships, the parents never wanted to talk about that anyway. You're the coach. I'm not at practice. I love talking to parents then because you can talk to them about other stuff. But as I say in my book, I made that mistake once with my oldest son, and I never made it again. I stayed out of it with both of my kids, and both of them, knock on wood, are in the real world now, and they're competing. And that's all you can ask for as a parent, is that your children go on to be fulfilled and independent in the real world as adults. Because that's that's when you see the results of whatever part you play in their lives as a parent.
Well, in your book, it's raising strivers here, and these are the critical people in our society. As a parent, and I've got a 10-year-old son out here, and this is something that intrigues me, and it seems to be this out-of-the-box thinking. It seems to be this idea that there are certain times that as a parent you can catch and teach at critical moments here and catch them at the right moment to where you can kind of bump and shift just a little bit and have them think a little bit differently and maybe have that kind of that eureka moment. Is that what we're after here, Coach?
Yeah, I think the key is first of all, the most important thing we do is model. It's not what we say to our kids or the so-called teachable moments. The teachable moments are modeling, number one, and number two, hoping that along the way they interact with teachers and coaches that will challenge them. I'm pure and simple. Because I think it's just as important what we don't do as what we do. For instance, if your child's having difficulty in a class, well, he needs to go talk to the teacher on his own. Is he working hard enough? That's the first question that needs to be asked. I don't think that parents should talk to teachers and coaches unless there's something really serious going on. I really don't. I just don't think it helps in the long run. And the long view is the most important view to always have in mind about your children. And most parents don't understand that before puberty, kids don't understand that hard work equals success. They say it because you've said it. They will mouth those words, but they, first of all, they don't really understand it, and they don't want to work hard. They want to play. They want to experience it. They're just figuring out who they are. They're becoming person. So a lot of it's hooked up in child development. I mean, I've always said if you give me a clone of your fourth grade boy who's really into basketball, you take your fourth grade boy to practice with a parent coach 3 times a week until the 7th grade. I drop my kid off to play pickup. When those two boys meet on the same 7th grade team, yours will be slightly ahead in the 7th grade because he'll have the etiquette down and the organization aspect. Mine will walk in the gym wanting to shut you down, not wanting to show off his 3. That might be the case, too, but he's going to want to shut you down. He's going to want to compete. He's going to have an edge, and he's going to be in 7th grade, and he has plenty of time to catch up in the other areas. That's probably the best example I can use. And that's why we used to be better in sports than we are now, because that used to be the approach, do less.
Coach, I'm going to have you think out of the box here for a little bit, okay? We've got the ultimate parenting issue occurring right now in the NCAA. The big-time parent here, the NCAA, is trying to do some parenting of its own with the children, the scholarship athletes. And somehow or the other, we've got this unionization issue coming up, and I don't know how this fits in. I mean, I think that the NCAA, like I said, is the parent. They're deciding what needs to be done for their student-athletes. The student-athletes here are rebelling a little bit, saying, hey, Mom and Dad, we need a little bit more here. In your opinion, what's going on out here?
That's a great way to put it. Well, you've got kids who've come off the assembly line who are entitled on the one hand, and then you've got athletic departments bringing in huge amounts of money. So really what's happened, and I don't have no idea what's going to happen. I think the system is broken because, again, you have to come back to the fundamental question, what is the purpose of college? Not the mission, because you can put everything in a mission, and it sounds wonderful, and stick it on the wall, and you can brand it and market it and put it on your business card, et cetera, but what is your purpose? And I don't think that's been defined. Is the purpose to entertain? Is the purpose to earn more, to bring in more revenue? Or is the purpose fundamentally to educate and to provide kids with an opportunity to grow and compete, grow as people? And college athletics has always been a situation where football and men's basketball primarily have brought in the revenue that supports the rest of us. But now the sums of money are so huge that the athletes are saying, you're selling my jersey. The coach is making millions, and I'm getting nothing for it. Again, I don't think the answer is paying the players. That's not college. If that's the answer, then it needs to become professional. Then that's a whole different. Then it becomes a farm system. I'm okay with it as long as we decide what is the purpose, where are we going with this? Because really, I don't think any in between is going to work.
Which, does it seem like that the NCAA institutions seem to be more concerned with the fan experience rather than the player experience?
Well, I think they're concerned with bringing in more and 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 more revenue. I mean, that's the number one concern at all of these, especially the high Division I. It's just revenue, raising more and more money. It's an arms race. And I'm hoping that some college president somewhere stands up and says, enough, and sets a precedent. Because I think, and you and I have talked about this, I think the solution is to make the scholarship worth it. My dad always said to me, and I was having to work and take out loans, and yet he still said to me, he said, a college education is priceless because of the relationships you build. It's impossible to put a price on it. Well, I used to buy into that, but now with the huge amounts of money that are being brought in, it's just not, it's really spoiled the college experience for the athletes from the standpoint of the experience is meant to help them grow as people, and you can't grow as people unless the focus is on competing, not on bringing in more revenue.
Coach, in your opinion and experience in the big-time college athletic world, can college tennis survive the unionization of college athletics?
I don't see how. I don't know, but I don't see how. Again, only if college sports becomes professional, and then I don't know how you support all the sports, for sure. I think you'd end up with football and basketball, maybe. But I don't think schools don't want to go in that direction. The latest is that most schools in the Big Five conferences are looking at paying the cost of full attendance, which could be $2,000 or $3,000 extra per athlete, and this would be all athletes in those departments, and that's expensive. That could be $1 million extra dollars at some schools. But they're sort of committed to doing that because with the football playoff, I've heard administrators say that the amount of money coming in will be obscene. I've heard that word used. It will be out of control. So I think they will be able to afford the cost of full attendance, and I guess administrators are hoping that sort of mollifies the athletes. I think the athletes are – I think the point behind wanting to unionize at Northwestern isn't wanting to be paid per se. They want protection. In the case of football, they want to be taken care of after their careers if they have concussions or injuries, et cetera. They want the kinds of protections that they feel like they should be getting as athletes who are putting themselves at risk for the university. I think that's more the point of that particular movement. But then, as you point out, you got the O'Bannon suit, which is selling an athlete's likeness. That's a whole different issue. So it's very complicated. I don't know where it's going. It's why I've really started to focus on younger kids. I watch college sports. It's entertaining. But I don't think it's a place where – I don't think it's an environment where kids – not every kid and not every team, but in general, college athletics is no longer an environment where kids can experience personal growth, can be made to feel uncomfortable where that's acceptable. And you know what I mean by uncomfortable. I don't mean yelling, screaming, throwing chairs. I mean setting up a practice that's truly challenging, that makes you get out of your comfort zone.
Coach, I'm curious, has the USTA contacted you to focus on their youth programs and see if you can identify some of the strivers within their junior development program?
No, and, you know, I don't think that I don't know. I don't think that I think the key is the parents. The USTA is going to answer to, they want more members. They want world champions. And then we're right back to, if all you ever think about is developing a world champion, you're not doing what's necessary at the grassroots level to cultivate a young boy or girl who might become that person. Do you see my point? It's right back to the emphasis is in the wrong place. And, of course, it's not smart marketing. It doesn't create a lot of buzz if you're going to – I know they have a grassroots program. But we have a new football coach at Texas, Charlie Strong, and he's been described as real. He doesn't talk much. He holds his players. He loves his players, but he's extremely demanding, and he wants them to be accountable. And he doesn't talk about it unless he has to anybody else but his players. That's the ideal environment. But that's not the environment we live in. We live in a personal branding, impression management, strategic culture.
Very gutsy, this guy yesterday, or in the last couple of days, announces to the Longhorn Nation, you guys will not be in the national championship game next year.
Yeah. Well, you can remember a day when that would have been quoted in an article and someone would have said, oh, my God, what's that all about? And then it would have died. But, of course, with social media, it's just, I don't know, he's being honest, and he sort of backtracked a little bit, but I don't know. I think he's being honest. He's being real. He's challenging his players. Why does any athlete at Texas or any other school, why do they have the right to think they're special? They haven't done anything yet for him, for those coaches, I'm saying. You know, you've got to earn your self-esteem. You've got to earn everything you get, and that's what college coaches struggle again, because of the environment, because of the impression management marketing environment, they struggle with the culture to create that kind of environment for their players. You know,